Welcome to the PodTech.net special podcast here at the Demo Conference. We have two luminary venture capitalists and seasoned entrepreneur executives, Bud Colligan and Mike Boych. That's it.
Yes. Got it right.
Welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great to be here.
So one of the things we want to talk about here is entrepreneurship in Silicon Valley. You guys have been around the block a few times. And going back to the Apple early days, take us through a little bit of the history of what it's like to see the new Apple and where it's come from.
Well, I think Apple is showing, you know, the genius of Steve again, both when we were there creating the Macintosh, which was an incredibly exciting experience and one that you think probably won't be recreated the rest of your life. And here he is doing it again with the iPod and the new iMacs and iTunes. So I think it's really a testament to his entrepreneurial abilities and his vision that Apple is back in the game in a big way.
Well, you guys work together at Apple. Mike, what did you guys? How did you guys interact? What were your roles? What did you guys do at Apple, and what year was that?
Sure. Well, I joined Apple in 1982, and I joined to recreate the product that was paying the bills at the time was the Apple II. And the thing that made the Apple II better than every other computer out there was for some reason, third-party software developers had gotten on board and created applications. So we wanted to recreate that phenomenon for the Macintosh. And we didn't want to pay people to do that. We wanted to just kind of convince them to do it. And so we actually coined the term evangelize. And my title was software evangelist. And now that's actually an accepted position in the business, I guess. It's mainstream. But so I had a group who were really working with developers and getting applications created for the Mac. Yeah, that was a relatively challenging thing to do because it was the first graphical user interface computer.
And the software industry was at the very beginning of the early stages of that whole formation.
Right.
Kind of
they
very similar.
They just learned how to do text applications on the IBM PC. And so transitioning from that to a mouse and menus and everything else was a huge.
Primitive architecture, not a lot of memory, a lot of assembler, a lot of stuff. You had the code.
Absolutely. I remember going to software publishing and getting them up and running on the Mac, and the first time one of their programmers encountered a bug and found out that she had to look at assembly language and a debugger to make it all work was not a happy day for them. But it was. They put all the load on the
Here's
developer.
The core dump. Figure it out.
Right. Yeah, the idea was make life good for the customers, but the developers have to suffer to make that work.
Talk about some of the early days. What was it like there? I mean, a lot of folks like me, I was in high school at the time, and it's 16 years old when you guys started working there. I had an Apple II. It was my second computer. TRS-80, Radio Shack was my first one. But what was it like there? I mean, what was the chaos? Was it chaotic?
It was a small company.
How many people?
It was
people?
A bit of a cult. When I got there, there were about a dozen people on the Mac team, and we were in a building behind a gas station, which we affectionately called Texaco Towers, a little bit near the main Apple campus, but not on it. And there was, Steve had already laid down this rule that there would never be more than 100 people in the Mac division, which obviously wouldn't work too well today. But so it was, very much everybody that interviewed with the entire team. It was really a high bar, at least in terms of what we thought we were, in terms of our evaluation of who got into the group. And the idea was just be incredibly productive. Hardly anybody, Bud and I were both married, but most everybody there was single, stayed there 20 hours a day, probably working 10 of those and gossiping and goofing around for the other 10. But it was an incredibly fun period.
Any war stories, Bud, there from Apple early days, folks out there?
Well, one of the things I was just going to add to what Mike said was that working with small groups is cool. I did a lot of liaison between the factory and our software development group as we were getting ready to ship the Macintosh. If you remember, the Mac shipped or was available and announced with the Super Bowl ad on January 24th, 1984.
Yeah. And that I was there at Stanford Stadium.
Yeah, that started.
Niners won.
That started.
85. That was bad.
That was the next year. Oops, wrong. Yeah. Yeah. Wrong Super Bowl.
That was the Lemmings.
but that started the whole Super Bowl ad thing. Yeah, you know, really. And so that we see today has grown so much that everyone wants to do an ad in the Super Bowl. But what I thought was so interesting was working with people like Andy Hertzfeld and Jerome Coonan, who was managing the software development, and Bill Atkinson. As we were shuffling disks to the factory, did we have the final version? And one of the really interesting war stories is that disk was being worked on, and debug, but new features being added or things being not new features being added, but bugs being corrected up until about 12 hours before it was final. And people worked all through the night. We took it to the factory at about 6 a.m. in the morning. And, you know, it was just amazing that there weren't more deadly bugs in that software when it shipped. Because, you know, there, when you do the final version, you do 12 hours of testing. That's not really sufficient to make sure that it's a high-quality release. But more or less it was. And I think it's testament to this small team focus that there was. There was only probably, what, 8 or 9 guys.
The software team was at less.
Doing all the software for the Macintosh.
How long did you guys stay there for?
I stayed there until 1985. That's when I left and started my first company. But the other thing Bud just reminded me of is because my job working with developers, one of the primary things I had to do was be the liaison to Microsoft, which at the time was a 300-employee company. It was on one floor of an office building in Seattle.
And they would DOS out. Okay. Windows wasn't even on the radar at this point.
We gave them 4 Macintoshes and under these, you know, very strict NDAs, and there was all this paranoia about whether they would copy it, et cetera, and I guess all the paranoia was ultimately justified. But there was a lot of turbulence in that relationship.
What was it like at Microsoft back then? Were you dealing with Bill directly, and who was the key
there
guy?
So there was Bill, and then there was John Shirley was the kind of the I guess it was the president. Bill was the CEO. There was a really crack development team. They just hired a guy, their first sort of real computer scientist from Xerox PARC, a guy named Charles Simone, who's a pretty well-known guy that just left Microsoft maybe 3 or 4 years ago. So Charles was kind of the technical visionary for the GUI applications. There was a guy named Jeff Harbers who really ran the development, who I remain good friends with. And they, like us, they had a team, I think maybe of 10 programmers who were cranking out these applications, and there was quite a kinship between us and their application developers, but also a bit of suspicion and tension all the time.
Yeah, a little rivalry. You know, I wish I had that user interface kind of. And it's been portrayed as this, you know, Pirates of Silicon Valley kind of, you know, thing. I mean, that is all. I mean, what is the real scoop?
Well, there was actually a scene in that movie that I was pretty close to what really happened. We had, you know, there was a lot of tension building up, and so we had this meeting that was, Steve and his counterpart at Microsoft, which would be Gates, and then me and my counterpart, which was Jeff Harbers, the guy who's running the apps team, and a couple, you know, half dozen other people, and where Steve accused them of stealing our stuff and developing Windows, and Bill came back, and Steve said, "It's not that I believe you're a crook, but I think my team believes that, so what do we do about that?" And Bill came back and said, "No, Steve, I think it's more like we both had this rich neighbor named Xerox, and you went to steal the TV, and you found out I'd already stolen the TV, and he said, that's not fair, I want the TV." So,
It went down that way. So it was pretty much that direct, calling each other out, little gloves off.
It was. Yeah, Steve tried to convince them that they really didn't need to develop operating systems, that applications is where the money was. And it is where a lot of the money is, but it doesn't hurt to control the
platform. What happened after that? Was that actually breaks the relationship that you were managing? I mean, at that point, I mean, how does the liaison into Microsoft deal with that kind of crack in the foundation?
It was interesting. I mean, we hung in there, and they hung in there because there was a lot at stake. Lotus started developing Jazz, which was going to be a Microsoft killer. And Microsoft actually was working on Excel at that time because their first spreadsheet was a much less interesting spreadsheet called MultiPlan. And Microsoft didn't tell us at all that they were working on this thing called Excel, which turned out to be a huge boon to the Mac when it was finally introduced. So I guess the relationship grew a bit more distant, but the invisible hand.
It was feeding into each other. So I guess the question for future industry builders is find the rich neighbor who's out of town and take the TV. That builds the industry. They're asleep at the switch, leaves the door open. You know.
Another funny war story, John, was when Mike mentioned MultiPlan, I just thought of this. Steve insisted that we worked on the Apple II for a long time, but once the Macintosh was actually capable of some output, we started using the Macintosh for our work, for word processing documents. We did the whole business plan in MacWrite, and the only spreadsheet we had was MultiPlan for Microsoft, but it was incredibly buggy, and I was doing all the forecasting, and Steve and I would go to these forecasting meetings with the
head of sales at Apple because we were a division.
And who was that at the time?
Apple II, Floyd Kwame.
Okay.
Floyd Kwame was the VP of sales.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah.
Mark Kwame's father, right?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
And so we'd go to these meetings, but to get to the meeting, I'd have to put together a spreadsheet. Well, you know, it would crash 10, 15 times a day, and sometimes I would lose the data. And then we had to print it on our ImageWriter, which was the new printer that we were going to ship from Apple's peripheral division. And so
that was the laser, not the dot matrix.
No,
that
dot matrix.
This was the ImageWriter. Oh, ImageWriter.
ImageWriter was the dot matrix printer.
Got it.
And so we'd have to print out these spreadsheets, and then
I wonder if half my audience doesn't even know what a dot matrix printer is these days.
Anyway, you print out multiple pages and then tape them together and then take them over to the copier and reduce them. And, of course, the funniest thing was there was really no forecasting because Steve always told me what the number should be. You know, he said, we're going to ship 600,000 units in the first year. Make the spreadsheet say that. So it's always a funny
forecast. How did Floyd Kwame deal with that?
Well, it was funny. Sometimes we went in because I was good friends with the guy doing the forecasting for the Apple II division. We'd call each other before the meeting, and we'd say, what's your number? He'd say, what's my number? And sometimes that number was greater than the total available market, so we'd always get a good chuckle out of that.
It helped that Steve was the general manager of the Mac division, but he was also chairman of the company. So
that carried a lot of weight.
A little bit reviled by the rest of the company because we tended to get whatever resources we needed, independent of any promise that they thought that we showed at that point in time.
That's great. And so what happened next in terms of the history, obviously? But when did you leave? What year did you leave? You were there in 83.
Yeah. Well, what happened, Mike mentioned sort of these three phases when Scully and Steve had the breakup. That was July of 1985. And the whole company was reorganized into functional groups at that point. Before we were
product, the matrix Pepsi organization type model, right?
Yeah, before we were product divisions, and then we had like a whole sales organization, a whole marketing organization, a whole engineering organization, and I moved into higher education and became the director of higher education marketing, and I did that from 85 until the end of 88 when I went off to be CEO of Authorware, which eventually became Macromedia.
I mean, there's so many historic points of interest in the time period that you guys were living, this beginning of the revolution, the computer revolution, obviously. You know, you had software development, which obviously became an industry. And obviously, we're going through some of those changes now with, you know, RSS, as we were talking about. You were at Macromedia, seeing the multimedia is now hitting the scene. What can you share with the folks out there that you've learned from those early Apple days that can be passed on as kind of words of wisdom in terms of what not to do, what to do, and just lessons learned, because that was a historic time?
Yeah, well, it's interesting looking backwards. I mean, the one lesson would be a terrible thing for a venture capitalist to say, but if you look at the Macintosh as a project, had it not been Apple, had it not had hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank, it would have failed simply because that Bud's forecast didn't come true. I guess maybe we built 250,000 units in the first year, maybe, and found homes for them eventually. But there, you know, there were some ugly times there. So,
in terms of inventory,
yeah, in terms of, you know, the software evangelism actually paying off, and there being enough useful applications, and people just grokking the whole idea of GUI and taking the whole thing seriously. That took more than, you know, than a year for it to become a really successful product. So for startups, you're back to kind of sizing what you're trying to do, how big of a revolution it is.
It was a big risk, no money in the bank, Apple craters, right?
Absolutely.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah, the Apple II still hung in there and sold well and paid the bills, you know, that plus the IPO proceeds and all that good stuff. But so, you know, matching the amount of change you're trying to create in the world and the amount of change of behavior you're trying to get from people against the time and the money you have to do it is an obvious lesson, but one that we live through pretty vividly.
So if you want to create a revolution, be well-funded.
Exactly. Have some friends that will help you.
Bud, what's your view on that? So you're on the marketing side, brand, and you've got Regis McKenna, and you have the whole aura of Apple, and Apple is one of the most amazing brands on the planet.
Yes, I think lessons learned, I think, as you, just everything from Apple up until today is, you know, a great brand counts, and but developing a great brand takes a lot of money, and it's really great to be first and then take advantage of that and build on it, and I think Apple did that extremely well. another lesson is great products. I don't think, you know, if you've been in the Valley long, you know that nothing really starts until you have a great product. And people that don't have great products, there's no faster way to kill a not-so-great product than great marketing. So as soon as a lot of people find out that it's not great, it'll go away really quickly. I think with Apple's new products, it shows that again, you know. And at Macromedia, we had awesome products that customers just loved. That was what was so neat working there was the creative people would always come up to you at the user conferences or trade shows and say how your products had really changed their life. It let them start a business. It let them, you know, feed their family. It let them hire people, and it really made a huge impact on their lives. So,
you and I were talking about this last night at dinner about product-centric view and the new management style. I think you were calling it the Steve Jobs management style. What's your view? Is it product-centric now? I mean, the passion and the commitment?
Well, I think products are very, very important, but there's other elements of the culture that's important as well. But great, you know, it starts with great products. But how do you create great products? I think you hire really great people. You set a vision for what you're trying to do, and you exercise strong leadership to get there. And I think if you do all those things, you'll create a great company.
Mike, any final thoughts on the Apple history and just shooting forward the arrow in this world?
Bud put it well. I think you do all those things in terms of product excellence and marketing and brand, and it still helps to catch a wave.
And you're an entrepreneur now at Interwest Partners, and Bud's at XL Partners as well. You guys are venture capitalists now and looking at new hot startups. Thanks so much for the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.